This KPCT podcast, sponsored by Karen Pryor Academy for Animal Training and Behavior. Get the details on our professional dog trainers program. We develop, certify, and support excellent teachers and trainers. Visit www.karenpryoracademy.com or call 800-472-5425. That's 800-472-5425.
Chapter 2, Shaping. Developing super performance without strain or pain. What is shaping? Reinforcing behavior that is already occurring, so that it occurs more often, is all very well. But how do trainers get their subjects to do things that would probably never occur by chance? How do you get a dog to turn back flips, or a dolphin to jump through a hoop? Dogs flipping, dolphins jumping through hoops, or people throwing basketballs through hoops for that matter, are developed by shaping. Shaping consists of taking a very small tendency in the right direction and shifting it, one small step at a time, toward an ultimate goal. The laboratory jargon for the process is successive approximation. Shaping is possible because the behavior of living things is variable. Whatever a creature does, it will do it with more vigor at some times than at others, in different directions, and so on. No matter how elaborate or difficult the ultimate behavior you wish to shape, you can always, by establishing a series of intermediate goals, find some behavior presently occurring to use as a first step. For example, suppose I decided to train a chicken to dance. I might begin by watching the chicken moving around, as chickens do, and reinforcing it every time it happened to move to the left. Soon my first goal would be reached. The chicken would be moving to its left quite often, and being variable, sometimes a little and sometimes a lot. Now I might selectively reinforce only the stronger movements to the left, turning a quarter circle, say. When these responses predominated, natural variability would again ensure that while some turns were less than a quarter circle, some would be more like a half a circle. I could raise my criteria, set a new goal, and start selecting for half-circle turns, or better. With the chicken shaped to make several full turns at high speed per reinforcement, I might consider that I'd reached my end goal, a dancing chicken. We are all quite accustomed to shaping and being shaped. In an informal way, much of child-rearing is a shaping process. The training of any physical skill, from tennis to typing, consists largely of shaping. We are also shaping when we try to change our own behavior, to quit smoking, say, or to be less shy, or to handle money better. Our success or failure in shaping a behavior in ourselves or in others ultimately depends not upon our shaping expertise, but upon our persistence. New York Times music critic Harold Schoenberg wrote of a European conductor who was not really a good conductor, but who made fabulous music by keeping his orchestra in rehearsal for each concert for a full year. Most of us can acquire at least some proficiency in almost anything if we just put enough time into it. But that's boring. Don't we always want to learn new skills, skiing, piano playing, whatever, as fast as possible? Of course we do. And that's where good shaping comes in. Further, don't we prefer to avoid or minimize repetition? Yes, again. Of course, some physical skills require repetition because muscles learn slowly and must be put through the motions repeatedly before the motions come easily. Even so, a well-planned shaping program can minimize the required drilling and can make every moment of practice count, thus speeding up progress tremendously. And finally, in sports, music, and other creative endeavors, you may want to develop not only reliable performance, but as good a performance as you or the one you're training can possibly give. In that case, correct use of the laws governing shaping may be crucial. Methods versus principles. There are two aspects to shaping: the methods, that is, the behaviors that are to be developed and the sequence of steps used to develop them, and the principles, or rules, governing how, when, and why those behaviors are reinforced. Most trainers, most books about training, and most teachers of training are concerned almost entirely with the method. Place your hands on the golf club as in the drawing. Line up your rifle sights before you aim at the target. Never lean into the mountain. Beat the eggs with a wire whisk in a clockwise direction. This is fine. Such methods have usually been developed over many years by many people through trial and error, so they do work. It's probably true that you'll sit on a horse more securely if you keep your heels down, or that your golf ball will go farther if you shape a good follow-through into your swing. If you are interested in learning a particular skill, I would strongly urge that you find out as much as possible about the established methods of accomplishing the behaviors that that skill involves through books, teachers, or coaches, and through watching or studying others. On the other side of shaping, however, are the principles, the rules that control such matters as when to press on and when to let up, how to escalate your criteria most efficiently, what to do when you run into trouble, above all, perhaps, when to quit. These questions are generally left to the intuition and experience of trainers or coaches, or to chance or luck. Yet it is the successful application of such principles that makes the difference between an adequate teacher and a great one, and between shaping that is happy, fast, and successful, and shaping that is frustrating, slow, boring, and disagreeable. It's good shaping, not just good methods, that makes training effective. The 10 Laws of Shaping. There are 10 rules that govern shaping, as I see it. Some come straight from the psychology labs and have been demonstrated experimentally. Others have not even been the subject of formal study so far as I know, but can be recognized as inherently valid by anyone who has done a lot of shaping. You always know, usually an instant too late, when you've broken one. I'll list the rules here and then discuss each one at some length. 1. Raise criteria in increments small enough that the subject always has a realistic chance for reinforcement. 2. Train one aspect of any particular behavior at a time. Don't try to shape for two criteria simultaneously. 3. During shaping, put the current level of response onto a variable schedule of reinforcement before adding or raising the criteria. 4. When introducing a new criterion or aspect of the behavioral skill, temporarily relax the old ones. 5. Stay ahead of your subject. Plan your shaping program completely so that if the subject makes sudden progress, you are aware of what to reinforce next. 6. Don't change trainers in midstream. You can have several trainers per learner, but stick to one trainer per behavior. 7. If one shaping procedure is not eliciting progress, find another. There are as many ways to get behavior as there are trainers to think them up. 8. Don't interrupt a training session gratuitously. That constitutes a punishment. 9. If behavior deteriorates, go back to kindergarten. Quickly review the whole shaping process with a series of easily earned reinforcers. 10. End each session on a high note if possible, but in any case, quit while you're ahead. Discussion of the rules. Rule 1. Raise criteria in increments small enough that the subject always has a realistic chance of reinforcement. In practice, this means that when you increase demands or raise a criterion for reinforcement, you should do so within the range the subject is already achieving. If your horse clears 2-foot jumps, sometimes with a foot to spare, you could start raising some jumps to 2.5 feet. But raising them all to 3 feet would be asking for trouble. The animal is capable of this, but is not offering it regularly yet. And raising the jumps to 3.5 feet would be courting disaster. How fast you raise the criteria is not a function of the subject's actual ability now or in the future. Never mind if the horse is a big, leggy creature potentially capable of jumping 8 feet, or if it habitually hops over 4-foot pasture fences. How fast you can raise the criteria at the level that you're working is a function of how well you are communicating through your shaping procedure what your rules are for gaining reinforcement. Every time you raise a criterion, you are changing the rules. The subject has to be given the opportunity to discover that though the rules have changed, reinforcers can easily continue to be earned by an increase in exertion. And also, in some cases, they need to know that performing at the old level no longer works and doesn't earn a reinforcer. This can be learned only by experiencing reinforcement at the new level. If you raise the criteria so high that the subject has to exert itself far beyond anything it has previously done for you, regardless of what it does or doesn't do on its own time, you are taking a big risk. The behavior may break down. A jumper might learn bad habits such as balking or knocking down jumps, habits that will be very time-consuming to eliminate. The fastest way to shape behavior, sometimes the only way, is to raise the criteria at whatever interval it takes to make it easy for the subject to improve steadily. Constant progress, even if only inch by inch, will get you to your ultimate goal much faster than trying to force rapid progress at the risk of losing good performance altogether. I once saw a father make a serious error in this regard. Because his teenage son was doing very badly in school, he confiscated the youth's beloved motorcycle until his grades improved. The boy did work harder, and his grades did improve, from Fs and Ds to Ds and Cs. Instead of reinforcing this progress, however, the father said that the grades had not improved enough and continued to withhold bike privileges. This escalation of the criteria was too big a jump. The boy stopped working altogether. He furthermore became very mistrustful. Rule 2. Train one aspect of any particular behavior at a time. Don't try to shape for two criteria simultaneously. I don't mean that you can't be working on many different behaviors over the same period of time. Of course you can. In any sort of lesson, we might work on form for a while and then on speed, in tennis on the backhand, then the forehand, then on footwork, and so on. It relieves monotony. Good teachers vary the work all the time, leaving one task as soon as some progress has been made and going on to another. While you are working on a given behavior, however, you should work on one criterion at a time and only that one. If I were training a dolphin to splash, and I were to withhold reinforcements one time because the splash was not big enough, and the next time because it was in the wrong direction, the animal would have no way of deciphering what I wanted from it. One reinforcement cannot convey two pieces of information. I should shape for size of splash until satisfied with that, and then shape for direction of splash, whatever the size, until that too is learned. Only when both criteria are established could I require both to be obeyed to earn a reinforcer. Rule 2 has a lot of practical applications. If the task can be broken down into separate components, which are then shaped separately, the learning will go much faster. Take learning to putt. Putting a golf ball depends on sending it the right distance, not short of the cup and not past it or over it, and sending it in the right direction, not to one side of the cup or the other. If I were going to teach myself to putt, I would practice these separately. Perhaps I would put a piece of tape on the grass, several feet long, and practice hitting the ball just across the tape, first from 2 feet, then 4, 6, and 10, and so on. I might also make a circle of tape and practice aiming at it from a fixed distance, gradually reducing the circle's size until I could hit a very small target reliably. Only when I was satisfied with my skills for both distance and direction would I combine them, setting up a large target size and varying the distance, then reducing the target size and varying the distance again until I could hit a small target at many distances. I would then add more criteria one at a time, such as putting uphill. This might make me an excellent or even a superb putter, depending on my dedication and the upper limits of my hand-eye coordination. It would certainly, within my capacity, make me a reliable putter. What I am suggesting is that any golfer could improve more in a few weekends following such a single-task shaping program than in a whole summer of random putting practice, hoping willy-nilly to get both the correct distance and the right direction on every shot. Often when we seem to show no progress in a skill, no matter how much we practice, it is because we are trying to improve two or more different things at once. Plain practice is not shaping. Repetition by itself may ingrain mistakes just as easily as improvements. One needs to think, does this skill have more than one attribute? Is there some way to break it down and work on different criteria separately? When you address both of these questions, many problems solve themselves. Rule 3. During shaping, put the current level of response onto a variable schedule of reinforcement before adding or raising the criteria. Many people initially object to the idea of using positive reinforcers in training because they imagine that they will forever have to hand out treats to get good behavior. But the opposite is true. Training with reinforcement actually frees you from the need for constant vigilance over the behavior because of the power of variable schedules. A variable schedule of reinforcement simply means that sometimes you reinforce a behavior and sometimes you don't. Often when we are teaching the behavior, we use a fixed schedule of reinforcement. That is, we reinforce every adequate behavior. But when we are just maintaining a behavior, we reinforce very occasionally, using a sporadic or intermittent schedule. For example, once a pattern of chore sharing has been established, your roommate or spouse may stop at the dry cleaners on the way home without being reinforced each time. But you might express thanks for an extra trip made when you are ill or when the weather is bad. When we train with aversives, however, and that's the way most of us began, we are usually taught that it is vital to correct every mistake or misbehavior. When errors are not corrected, the behavior breaks down. Many dogs are well behaved on the leash, where they might get jerked, but they are highly unreliable as soon as they are off leash and out of reach. When errors are not corrected, the behavior breaks down. Many dogs are well behaved on the leash when they might get jerked, but they are highly unreliable as soon as they are off leash and out of reach. When out with their friends, many teenagers do things that they wouldn't dream of doing in their parents' presence. This can happen because the subject is fully aware that punishment is unavailable. When the cat's away, the mice will play. But it can also happen as a side effect of training with aversives. Since the message in a punisher is, "Don't do that," the absence of the aversive sends the message, "That is okay now." With positive reinforcement, on the other hand, not only is it not necessary to reinforce every correct response for a lifetime, but it is crucial to the learning process to skip an occasional reinforcer. Why? The heart of the shaping procedure consists of selectively reinforcing some responses rather than others, so that the response improves little by little until it reaches a new goal. All behavior is variable. When you skip an expected reinforcer, the next behavior is likely to be somewhat different. Thus, the skipped reinforcer enables you to select stronger or better responses. That's sometimes called a differential or selective schedule of reinforcement. You are choosing to reinforce only some kinds of responses, those that meet, say, the requirement of being faster or longer, or facing left but not right. But to an inexperienced learner who until now has been earning reinforcers pretty predictably, skipping reinforcers can be a shock. Your puppy sits, you click and treat for the sit, the puppy sits faster and more gleefully, "Look, I'm sitting, click me!" And now suddenly some sits don't work. If your puppy has not learned to withstand an occasional skipped reinforcer, it may well quit in despair or go back to a weaker or slower response. While this step is not mentioned in the learning textbooks, in practice it is useful. If you are working with a new and inexperienced learner, to deliberately teach your trainee to tolerate small variations in the reinforcement schedule before you begin to select for bigger or better responses. Your subject has to be able to tolerate an occasional failure per se, without stopping the behavior altogether. Or, technically speaking, you need to establish an intermittent schedule of reinforcement before starting to hold out for improved performance through a differential schedule of reinforcement. In dog training seminars in the 1990s, I labeled this type of variable schedule, a brief use of intermittent reinforcement, twofers, Broadway slang for two theater tickets for the price of one. Let the dog do it twice, two bumps of the target with its nose, say, for one click or treat. Learning to tolerate an intermittent schedule makes the behavior, and other subsequent behaviors, more resistant to extinction. There's another benefit to this brief use of an intermittent schedule during the learning phase. When your subject is able to tolerate the occasional skipped reinforcer, and you let a previously adequate response go by without a reinforcer, the learner is likely not only to repeat the behavior, but to repeat it with more vigor. "Hey, I did it, didn't you see me? Look, I'm doing it again." This intensified behavior, called an extinction burst, enables you to move more rapidly towards your goal behavior. A skilled shaper may even omit reinforcers specifically in order to provoke a varied or more vigorous response. Dog behaviorist Gary Wilkes calls this surfing the extinction bursts. Once the subject has learned that a skipped reinforcer does not mean the behavior was wrong, but simply that one might need to try again, the shaping flows from continuous reinforcement as a new behavior surfaces to differential reinforcement as we select for better form, longer duration, faster speed, shorter latencies, and so on, and then back to continuous reinforcement when the behavior is perfect or, in laboratory terms, meets criteria. Deliberate use of intermittent reinforcement is no longer necessary because the learner already tolerates variable schedules. Ultimately, when the behavior is satisfactory in all respects, it usually becomes part of a repertoire. One requires this behavior as a part of other more complex behaviors. Good form, speed, distance, and so on are blended into a whole, the race, the job, the day's activities, and that whole becomes the behavior that is reinforced. With this behavior, you are now back to an intermittent or maintenance schedule, just the sporadic clicks or thanks that serve to keep things running smoothly. The high rate of positive reinforcement, the flood of clicks and treats that you may have used in the beginning, can now be saved for learning some other new behavior. Rule 4. When introducing a new criterion or aspect of the behavioral skill, temporarily relax the old ones. Suppose you're learning to play squash and you've been working successfully on aim, sending the ball where you want it to go. Now you'd like to work on speed, but when you hit hard, the ball goes every which way. Forget about aim for a while and just slam the ball. When you have achieved some control over the speed of the ball, your aim will come back very quickly. What is once learned is not forgotten, but under the pressure of assimilating new skills, old, well-learned behavior sometimes falls apart temporarily. During the first dress rehearsal of an opera, I once saw a conductor having a tantrum because the singers in the chorus were making one musical mistake after another. They seemed virtually to have forgotten all their hard-learned vocal accomplishments. But they were, for the first time, wearing heavy costumes, standing on ladders, and being required to move about as they sang. Getting used to new requirements temporarily interfered with previously learned behavior. By the end of the rehearsal, the musical learning had reappeared without coaching. Dolphin trainers call this the new tank syndrome. When you move a dolphin to a new tank, you have to expect that it will, quote, forget all it knows until the new stimuli are assimilated. It's important to realize that berating yourself or others for mistakes in past learned behavior under new circumstances is not good training. The mistakes will usually clear up by themselves shortly, but reprimands cause upset and sometimes tend to draw attention to the mistakes so they don't go away. Rule 5. Stay ahead of your subject. Plan your shaping program so that if your subject makes a sudden leap forward, you will know what to reinforce next. I once spent 2 days shaping a newly captured dolphin to jump over a bar a few inches above the water surface. When the behavior was well established, I raised the bar another few inches. The animal jumped immediately and so easily that I shortly raised the bar again, and by a bigger increment. In 15 minutes, this novice animal was jumping 8 feet. A shaping breakthrough of this sort can happen at any time. We see the phenomenon in people, of course, and in many species of intelligent animals. Sometimes it's an example of insight. The subject suddenly realizes the point of what it's being asked to do, in this case to jump much higher, and goes out and does it. Killer whales are famous for anticipating shaping. Their trainers all have the same joke. You don't have to train killer whales, you just write the behavior on a blackboard and hang it in the water, and the whales will follow the script. Where trainers can run into trouble is if they are not ready for sudden improvement. If you as a trainer are going from A to B, and the subject suddenly does B perfectly in 2 reinforcements, you'd better have in mind steps C and D, or you'll have nothing further to reinforce. Breakthroughs often seem to be extremely exciting for the subject. Even animals appear to enjoy a kind of aha experience, and often rush about evincing elation. A breakthrough is thus a golden opportunity to make a lot of progress in a hurry. To be unprepared and to hold the subject at a low level of performance just because you don't know what to do next is at best a waste of time and at worst may discourage or disgust your subject so that it becomes less willing to work in the future. Except under the very best of circumstances, our whole school system seems to be set up to prevent children from learning at their own rate, to penalize not only the slow learners who don't get the time to learn, but the fast learners who don't get additional reinforcement when quick thinking moves them ahead. If you understand in a flash what your math teacher is talking about, your reward may be to writhe in boredom for hours, even weeks, while everyone else learns by inches. No wonder street life looks like more fun for the quick ones as well as the slow. Rule 6. Don't change trainers in midstream. While in the midst of shaping a behavior, you risk major slowdowns if you turn the training over to someone else. No matter how scrupulous one may be in discussing criteria before turning over the job, everyone's standards, reaction times, and expectations of progress are slightly different, and the net effect for the subject is to lose reinforcers until those differences can be accommodated. In a way, it's another example of new tank syndrome. Of course, one trainee may have many different teachers. We have no trouble when one trainer teaches us French, another arithmetic, another football. It is the individual behavior being learned that needs one teacher at a time. During the shaping or half-learned stages, consistency of the gradually escalating criteria is best maintained by keeping the shaping of a given behavior in one person's hands. So, if, say, you have two children and one dog, and both kids want to teach the dog tricks, let them. But let them each work on separate tricks, and spare the poor dog a lot of confusion. Those who want to learn will learn under the worst of circumstances. One of the by now well-known ape language experiments, in which apes are taught vocabularies in American Sign Language and other codes, took place at Columbia University and involved a baby chimpanzee named Nim Chimpsky. That's a joke. Because of budgetary and other problems, the poor creature had more than 100 teachers of signing in a 3-year period. The students and experimenters were disappointed that Nim showed no firm evidence of real language. That is, he apparently never made sentences on his own. But he did learn to recognize and understand more than 300 signs, nouns, verbs, and so on, which under the circumstances I think is amazing. And so some children go from school to school and through the hands of endless processions of substitute teachers and still learn, but there are better ways. The one time that you should consider changing trainers in mid-shaping is, of course, when the training is going nowhere. If little or no learning is occurring, you have nothing to lose by switching. Rule 7. If one shaping procedure is not eliciting progress, try another. No matter what the behavior, there are as many ways to shape it as there are trainers to think them up. In teaching children to swim, for example, one wants to get them to be fearless and comfortable about going underwater. As a first step in this shaping task, one teacher may get them blowing bubbles in the water. Another may have them put their faces in quickly and out again. A third may get them bobbing up and down until they dare to bob underneath. Any good teacher, seeing that a child is bored by or afraid of one method, will switch to another. The same shaping methods don't work equally well on every individual. Traditional trainers, such as circus trainers, often fail to grasp this point. Their shaping procedures have been honed over generations and passed down through families. This is the way you train a bear to ride a bicycle. This is the way you train a lion to roar. You tweak a few hairs out of its mane, if you want to know. These traditional recipes are considered the best ways, and sometimes they are, but they are also often considered the only ways, which is one reason why circus acts tend to look so much alike. Here's an example from my own experience. The radio and television star Arthur Godfrey, after doing a show at Sea Life Park, invited me to visit him and his wife at their farm in Virginia to watch the horse training. Godfrey was an excellent rider and trainer himself, and owned a number of performing horses. We were watching a horse being trained to bow or kneel on one knee by a traditional method involving two men and a lot of ropes and whips. The horse under this method is repeatedly forced onto one knee until it learns to go down voluntarily. I said it didn't have to be done that way and asserted that I could train a horse to bow without ever touching the animal. One possibility, put a red spot on the wall, use food and a marker signal to shape the horse to touch its knee to the spot, then lower the spot gradually to the floor so that to touch it correctly and earn a reinforcer, the horse has to kneel. I can think of several other ways too. Godfrey became so angry at my impertinent suggestion. The idea, if there were another way to train a bow, he would know about it. and he was so angry that we had to walk him around the outside of the barn two or three times to cool him off. It is amazing how tenaciously people will stick to a system that isn't working or that works badly, convinced somehow that more of the same will get results. Murray Sidman, PhD, a pioneering researcher in behavior analysis, maintains that this is the main reason why it's important to understand the principles and not just learn recipes. Everyone has a method. The principles govern what truly works. Rule 8. Don't interrupt a training session gratuitously. That constitutes a punishment. This doesn't apply to the casual, though meaningful and productive, shaping one might do around the house, praising schoolwork, welcoming homecomers, encouraging children. A reinforcer here and there with no formality will do fine. In a more formal situation, however, in giving a lesson, say, or in shaping behavior in an animal, the trainer should keep his or her attention on the training subject or the class until the training period is over. This is more than just good manners or good discipline. It is skilled training. When a subject is trying to earn reinforcers, it enters into a contract, so to speak, with the trainer. If the trainer starts chatting to some bystander, or leaves to answer the telephone, or is merely daydreaming and not paying attention, the contract is broken. Reinforcement is unavailable through no fault of the trainee. This does more harm than just putting the trainer at risk of missing a good opportunity to reinforce. It may punish some perfectly good behavior that was going on at the time. Of course, if you want to rebuke a subject, removing your attention is a good way to do it. Dolphin trainers call this a timeout and use it to correct misbehavior. Picking up the fish bucket and walking away for 1 minute is one of the few ways one has of saying no or wrong to a dolphin, and it is usually very effective. One wouldn't think dolphins could look chagrined or act contrite, but they can. Removal of attention is a powerful tool, so don't use it carelessly or unfairly. Mostly with dolphins, we use removing our attention as a rebuke for aggressive action from the animal, trying to strike or bite at the trainer or the fish bucket. Rule 9. If a learned behavior deteriorates, review the shaping. Sometimes a skill or behavior gets rusty or seems to be totally lost. We all know how it feels to try to speak a language or remember a poem or ride a bicycle if we haven't done it in years and years. It feels most unsettling. Sometimes outside circumstances will temporarily eradicate a well-learned behavior. When stage fright, for example, makes it impossible to give the thoroughly memorized speech, or a bad fall severely affects your rock climbing skills. Sometimes subsequent learning overlies or contradicts the original learning, so that mix-ups occur. You strive for the Spanish word and come up with the German. Sometimes the side effects of punishment or other aversive events interfere with unrelated behavior. Attorney and dog fancier Morgan Spector describes an obedience trial in which every single dog that competed shied away from one particular corner of the ring. What aversive lurked there? Only the dogs knew. Sometimes an apparently well-trained behavior just breaks down, and you never will identify the reason. Your high-scoring competition obedience dog, who has never done such a thing before in his life, gets up in the middle of the 3-minute long sit exercise and wanders out of the ring. Who knows why? Who cares why? What is needed is not justification, but an effective fix. The quickest way to correct this kind of deterioration is not to butt at it head-on, insisting that the subject get the whole thing back before you're satisfied or before you reinforce, but to recall the original shaping procedure and go all the way through it very rapidly, reinforcing under the new circumstances 20 years later, in public, in the rain, whatever, and just reinforcing once or twice at each level. At Sea Life Park, we call this going back to kindergarten. And the technique often brought a poor behavior up to par in 10 or 15 minutes. Of course, we are doing just this whenever we review for an exam or refresh our memories by glancing at a script before going on stage. It is useful to remember that if you can more or less match the original shaping process, reviewing works equally well for physical as for mental skills, and it works with animals as well as people. Rule 10. Quit while you're ahead. How long should a shaping session run? That depends partly on the attention span of the subject. Cats often seem to get restless after perhaps a dozen reinforcers, especially when they are new to clicker training. So 5 minutes might be plenty for a cat. Dogs and horses can usually work longer. Human lessons of many sorts are traditionally an hour long, and football practice, graduate seminars, and various other endeavors often go on much longer, even all day. When you stop is not nearly as important as what you stop on. You should always quit while you're ahead. This is true for whole sessions, but it also applies to stages within a session, when you stop working on one behavior and go on to another. You should move on a high note, that is, as soon as some progress has been achieved. The last behavior that was accomplished is the one that will be remembered best. You want to be sure that it was a good, reinforceable performance. What happens all too often is that we get 3 or 4 good responses. The dog retrieves beautifully. The diver does a 1.5 correctly for the first time. The singer gets a difficult passage right. And we are so excited that we want to see it again or to do it again. So we repeat it or try to. And pretty soon the subject is tired, the behavior gets worse, mistakes crop up, corrections and yelling take place, and we just blew a training session. Amateur riders are always doing this. I hate watching people practice jumping their horses. So often they go past the point when they should have stopped, when the animal was doing well, and before the behavior began falling apart. As a trainer, you should force yourself, if necessary, to stop on a good response. It takes guts sometimes. But you may find that in the next session, the retrieve, the somersault dive, the solo obbligato is not only as good as the last one of the previous session, but noticeably better. At the start of the next session, the performance may actually begin a step beyond where it left off, and then you have just that much more to reinforce. Shaping behavior is, of course, the opposite of training by drill and repetition. It can produce not only steady progress, but absolutely error-free training, and this can go extremely fast. I once halter broke a yearling pony in 15 minutes, from start to finish, and permanently. By moving back and forth between 5 shaping tasks, forward, stop, left, right, and back, while reinforcing very small progress in each one. Accomplishing such speedy training depends, paradoxically, on your willingness to give up time limits, specific goal setting, and speed of progress itself as goals. You must instead count simply on your willingness to quit while you're ahead, sort of a Zen phenomenon. Sometimes you can't end each training session on a high note. Perhaps the students paid for an hour and they won an hour, though a good quitting time was reached earlier. Or perhaps the session really isn't going well enough to provide a high point, and fatigue is soon going to be a problem. In that case, it is wise to end the session with some easy, guaranteed way to earn a reinforcer, so that the session as a whole is remembered as being reinforcing. Dolphin trainers often end long, demanding sessions with a bit of easy ball playing. Riding teachers sometimes use games, such as Simon Says or Tag, at the end of a lesson. The most inadvisable technique is to introduce new tasks or material late in the session so that the session always concludes with a series of inadequate and unreinforced behaviors. My piano lessons as a child always ended this way. It was very discouraging, and I still can't really play the piano.
This KPCT podcast, sponsored by Karen Pryor Academy for Animal Training and Behavior. Get the details on our professional dog trainers program. We develop, certify, and support excellent teachers and trainers. Visit www.karenpryoracademy.com or call 800-472-5425. That's 800-472-5425.